The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast. Hello, I'm Sarah Crown. This week, we're talking about how to approach that difficult second novel and speaking to second-timers Ross Rosen and Joe Danthorn about how they managed to pull it off. And with e-books encroaching further into the print market, we take a look at book formats. Kindle devotee Chris Moran joins us in the studio to explain why he's a convert, while Richard Lee picks up a new commuter-friendly handheld book and asks, can the flip book really take on e-readers? Claire Armistead is off on a well-earned break this week, but fear not, she's using the time wisely to catch up on her reading. And she's not the only one. According to a new report, we in the UK are the most prolific holiday readers in Europe, reading an average of 2.6 books each while we're away, which comes to a total of over 66 million books read in the holidays across the UK. And that's a lot of ink and paper to lug around. But these days, of course, we don't actually have to. Summer 2011 is the year when the e-reader has really come into its own. More and more of us are choosing to carry our holiday libraries with us in one electronic device weighing about the same as a slim paperback. Now, there's no doubting the convenience, but what do we lose by throwing out our paperbacks with their smears of sun cream and scatterings of sand? With me in the studio are Chris Moran, The Guardian's SEO editor and recent convert to the Kindle, and Richard Lee, who won't be parted from his paperbacks. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
So, Chris, you took your Kindle with you to Turkey this year. How did that work out for you?
Well, it was great. I mean, I was very suspicious of the Kindle. I'm one of those people who, you know, I like having my books on my shelves and displayed to tell everyone how very clever I am and what amazing variety of books I read. And my wife got one 3 months ago, and I laughed at her for having a Kindle and said, you know, it's terrible. And then we went on holiday and I thought, actually, I may as well pick one up. And it's genuinely been a revelation for me. I mean, there are the obvious things, the ease of it, the lack of carrying things around. Its price point is right. It just reached that, I think, critical mass price point. It just hit £109, is it something like that? And I think that's a really telling price, especially because you can buy one and immediately download 20 free classics, which would probably cost you £100 if you just went to the shop and bought them as paperbacks.
And so, but what about if you take it to read on the beach? Are you not worried about it getting kind of covered in sand and salt water?
I think that's the other key thing about that price point is, you know, it's £100. It's not an iPad. It doesn't look like it might break if you breathe on it. It's pretty robust, but it feels kind of utilitarian and, you know, it's just a useful thing to have around. Mm. You can sling it in a rucksack and it's fine.
Richard, you're not planning to invest your £100 in a Kindle.
Well, no, and I feel a bit of an old fuddy-duddy, but I'm perfectly happy to put my 2.6 books in my rucksack. It's partly force of habit. I mean, you know, it's the kind of practicality of the codex of the book is a well-acknowledged fact that you can flick through it, you can find where you are, you know how much further you've got to go, all that kind of stuff.
Now, that's an interesting point, because that's something that you do lose with a Kindle, isn't it? You don't have that sense of how far through the book you are.
Ah, but you do. And this is one of the things about the Kindle that's really struck me is like the analog on the Kindle for, you know, how far through it you are. There is a percentage read bar at the bottom of the screen. And I'm a kind of avid video gamer. And I think this in itself has just turned me back on to reading just because I like something that tells me how well I'm doing. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, if I read an extra percent, that really, you know, that
that's
really spurs
right
me on.
Yeah.
I know that makes me really, really superficial, but it has actually, as an object, it has changed my relationship with reading. I'd kind of gone off reading, I'd kind of stopped, and it's made me voracious again.
You want to just get through the percents?
Weirdly, yes.
In a way that the kind of the heft of the pages didn't have a kind of, it didn't count for you.
Strangely not.
So, you, Richard, you're using words like heft, which have a certain heft and poetry as well. And this is something that came from a blog that we did a few weeks ago about Penelope Lively, who said recently that, and I'm quoting from her now, anyone whose library consists of a Kindle lying on a table is some sort of bloodless nerd. What do you think of that? The romance of the book, the romance of the physical object, the fact that it becomes associated with the place that you take it away to, the fact that it does get covered in sand and sun cream. Is that enough to keep you reading ink and paper?
Well, I mean, the sensual peripherals are all very nice, and we're kind of all very used to them, but they are just peripherals. I mean, to me, the dominant issue is it doesn't really address the problem, because the problem is I want to read the book I'm reading now. I don't want 3,500 books in my library at any one point. I just want the thing I'm reading now. And there's always been a certain amount of consumerism in the experience of going to a bookshop, picking up a book, all this kind of, there's 3-for-2 tables. It's all been commoditized to that extent, I mean, for years now. But the actual act of reading a book has always been something very much kind of one-to-one between you and the page. And this potential for having another book, a different book, the new book, now, as you say, changes your relationship with it instantly at a stroke. I think that's a bit of a problem. The other problem is kind of a wider issue about the fact that Amazon, which already bestrides the publishing world like a behemoth, has talked itself into the situation with ebooks where it's got the dominant reader, it's got the dominant device. And that's got all sorts of problems for people going forwards about whether it's going to be possible to make money.
And Will Skidelsky blogged about this on the Guardian book site, talking about the pricing of ebooks, essentially. The fact that if you believe that a book is priced for the words that it contains, that that is the value that you're selling when you sell a book, there really shouldn't be that big a difference between the cost of a hardback book and the cost of an ebook. But there is a big difference, and he sort of goes on to talk about why, and part of the reason why is to do with Amazon's dominant position in the marketplace. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because that is interesting.
There's a few things there, I think, that's bound up in it. I think one thing that Amazon and the publishers need to be doing much better relates to the typography and the way that the ebooks are actually put out, and the format, even of new ebooks, which you pay a premium for, can be appalling. Somebody wrote a really nice blog about it recently. Apologies, I can't remember their name, but they noticed that the Kindle advert in The Guardian, the screenshot of the page, had absolutely hideous typography all over it. And they said that just underlined just how little Amazon cared about that aspect. And I think it's important. And I think it's something that lets the Kindle down at the moment and doesn't put the publishers or Amazon in a good light. In terms of the amount that you pay being actually more related to the text itself, I don't have a problem with that, because yes, that is what we're paying for, but I think that also ties into this slightly soody thing about, oh, the book and how important it is. Mm. It's the same thing, I remember hearing, you know, the same thing with LPs, vinyl and all of this. And actually, you know, one of the things about this, and when Penelope Lively says it's bloodless, well, the text is what you are reading. The text doesn't change. The actual story is still the same.
But it is a circular argument, isn't it? Because the text is what you're reading, you're right. So that would back up the argument that why do we care what format these things are delivered in? But if we don't care what format they're delivered in, then how come ebooks are so much cheaper than paperback books? Because if it's the text that we're talking about, then the text should cost the same much, surely, in any...
I mean, they're cheaper than the hardback books. That strikes me as a rather different and equally important thing to consider.
Well, then we get into the issue of hardback books and publishers.
Indeed.
Why we have hardbacks at all, I suppose. Richard, any thoughts?
Well, the hardback is a premium product which publishers have always relied on as a way of getting some money, what is essentially a pitching business where they've got to take a punt on an author, take a punt on their next work to try and get money in to do other things that they were always supported all along. And now with the kind of publishing revolution, it's possible for anybody to publish themselves at any point. You've got a whole universe of new voices which you would never have got publication via conventional publishers. And the question is whether, in the bottom line, whether writers and readers are going to get better books as a result of that cornucopia variety, or whether it's important to have gatekeepers of some sort, people who are deciding what the good stuff is, to put it out in front of people, and indeed whether there's a national conversation or a conversation of culture which results from the idea that we're all reading the same kind of books at the same time, whether that's something that is interesting and vital, or whether that's something that should be pushed to one side.
It's also about who or what suggests what are the books worth reading. Now, you could argue that social media has taken that role, rather than publishers referring people to interesting and new books.
But there's dangers in that, of course, in that you tend to have contacts via social media with people that you like or people that have the same interests of you. This means that there's a potential for culture to narrow and fragment, so that you have different groups of people all reading the same things that their friends like, but no actual crossover between the groups. And for all that it was a kind of paternalistic old boys network kind of culture before, it was at least something shared that you could take part in, or you could rebel against, or you could find your own ways around. But if that something shared no longer exists, I think we'll probably be the poorer for it.
Okay, well, we've moved quite a long way away from summer holidays now, and this is a conversation that could really go on all day. I think perhaps we could all join in below the line on the podcast and keep talking about it there. But let's move on to another new format for the book, for the text, for the words being delivered in a completely different way. If you're anti-Kindle, but you also resent giving over half your suitcase to hardbacks, then this type of book, the flipback book, may be for you. Richard, can you explain what a flipback book is?
Well, it's a new book format on printed paper. There you go. But it makes me despair of publishing almost. It's a little smaller, and the words are printed round the other way. So if you can imagine that you open it with the page going up and down rather than left to right. But it's basically a book. And I went down with one of these little books to show them to commuters at Euston Station in London.
I think it's an interesting development. If I could get books like this, yes, it'd be very useful for when I were travelling. Whether we'd be able to get all the content in, I don't know.
That's the whole book?
This is the whole book. But books come in different sizes, don't they? History at World by Chris Hartman. 700 pages. Would they be able to get 700 pages into a document like that?
So if they could get 700 pages into that, you'd be sold?
I think I would.
I think it looks fantastic. I think the text size looks fantastic. I think this is great. The paper might be a bit thin.
Can you turn it with one hand?
Yes, I can turn it with one hand. I've got my hands full, so I can turn it with one. No, this is great because you can stand up and you can probably hold on to the poles and the tube and read it. No, I like it. I like it a lot.
So do you think this new format could be the Kindle killer?
I don't think it'll be a Kindle killer. I think it'll be a Kindle matcher.
I haven't gotten onto this Kindle business yet. I usually keep my books here.
You have a kind of dedicated pocket for that?
Yes, yeah. So this would actually be a really good format.
I haven't turned my back against the printed word, absolutely. I have got a load of books on my shelves and they will never be replaced. I like travelling light and just having a book that doesn't weigh anything. It doesn't weigh anything, really.
I'm a commuter, so I want something small. And so, therefore, if I can put that in, then it means I don't have to spend £120 on an Amazon Kindle, and I can just put this in my bag instead. So, yeah, I'd say, yeah, I'd buy one.
Okay, so lots of heads being shaken around the table.
Astonished by those positive reactions. I mean, there were some who were less positive, but overwhelmingly, people loved it. I guess, I mean, there's a problem here that is there's a response bias that we have to take into account. Is that you show somebody something new and shiny and say, what do you think of that? They're going to say, oh, it's great, isn't it? But nevertheless, I was kind of shocked by how much people liked it.
Explain why you don't like it.
Well, it's just a book. I mean, it's a little bit smaller and the paper's a little bit thinner, but it's just
like
a book.
Kind of like Bible paper, isn't it?
Yeah,
like
kind of onion skinny.
Yeah.
And yes, you can turn it with one hand, but really that's never been a problem for me reading a book on the tube.
Chris, what about you?
Well, it really offends me. I think it's an answer to a problem that doesn't exist. It's an answer that only the publishing industry could have come up with, i.e. we have to cling on to print. I mean, the really interesting thing about the Kindle versus book debate is that nobody in that debate is saying that they think books are rubbish or need a redesign. That's just not the problem. Only this publishing industry could come up with this terrible idea. I mean, I think it's laughable. The thinness of the paper is actually more of an issue, I think, than has been described here. It's very difficult to turn a page accurately. It just looks comical to me. I mean, what are we going to have? People are going to be selling, you know, flip back book coats with seven pockets, you know, that are designed to fit one of these ridiculous objects.
I think to give publishers their due, it's probably more likely excitable journalists who are saying that it's a saviour of publishing. I think they're just kind of throwing anything up against a wall and seeing what sticks.
But not these two journalists in this room today. Just before taking off on holiday, Claire Armistead spoke to two young authors about how they followed up on their debut novels.
It's an old saw that the hardest book for a writer is often the second one. Jo Dunthorne burst onto the scene in 2008 with Submarine, a coming-of-age novel which, as one critic wrote, transplanted The Catcher in the Rye to South Wales. He's back with Wild Abandon. That's a title, not an attitude. It's once again set in Wales, though this time in a disintegrating hippie commune. Ross Raisin also arrived in 2008 with his novel God's Own Country about a dysfunctional teenager in Yorkshire farming country. We know about that at The Guardian because it very nearly won the Guardian First Book Award. He's taken on a very different locale in his new novel Waterline, which is set largely in Glasgow. Welcome, both of you.
Hello.
Now, Ross, I know you've, as well as giving birth to a book, you've just given birth to a baby, so double congratulations in order. Now, I began by uttering that old truism that the second book is harder than the first. Is this true of your experience, Joe?
It is 100% true, yeah. It was way harder and more grueling and less enjoyable. Me and Ross both had two-book contracts.
So you just had to do it, even if you didn't want to?
Well, yes. I mean, I did want to, but that's true. I mean, I was obliged to also. Why I say that is just because to write a sentence thinking, I'm the only person who's ever going to read this, I'm just enjoying myself, which is how I felt writing book one, and then to write a sentence thinking, Penguin are going to publish this, quite a different mental kind of backdrop.
Ross, how about you?
Yeah, I feel similarly, actually. I found it up and down, the second novel. In large part, I found it very difficult. And it's only kind of afterwards that I've been able to kind of step back and think about why I found it difficult. I think one reason is probably because of the subject matter itself. The book's a bit depressing, and I think that has an impact on you when you're writing. You're spending 3 or 4 years or whatever with it. But also, I feel like it creates a pressure on yourself to enjoy it, because you've been lucky enough to get a two-book deal or whatever, and it's looking like this is what you're going to be doing, certainly for the next few years, maybe a whole career, which makes you very fortunate because most people don't get that opportunity. And then you think, well, I better bloody enjoy it then, otherwise what's the point?
You go and build some ships.
Yeah, the thing that you forget is that a lot of it isn't very enjoyable. It's hard. There's lots of good moments and finishing is wonderful, but I think I forgot that a little bit, that it's a hard process.
So now let's turn to the books themselves. And since you've just been talking, Ross, you have made a huge journey for this book, haven't you? Away from Yorkshire, almost dialect, that your first novel was written in, towards a quite broad Glaswegian.
Yes, I'd say that's true. Both books are quite dialectal. I see this one as being more subtly dialectal than the first one, partly because it's in third person, I think. But I think it's to do with form more than anything else, and function, I suppose, because both books, even though one's first person, one's third person, they're very close to the main character, and it's in their voice. They're telling the story, pretty much. And because they come from certain localities, it would feel odd, I think, and disingenuous if I wasn't representing their language in the narrative. So
tell us what the story is.
How much of a nutshell do you want?
A nutshell.
Oh, good.
A smallish cobnut.
Okay. The book begins with the death of the main character's wife. It's just after her funeral, and the book follows this main character who used to be a shipbuilder in Glasgow, and it's about what happens to him as he grieves, and more broadly it's about what happens to him within his community and what has happened to that community as the shipyard industry has declined. Mm-hmm. And so it's about bereavement
of an elderly
of a
man,
person, and also of an industry.
Will you just give us a flavour of it now, reading from an early chapter?
Yes. The multis stand solid in a row like a picket line, looking down over the red tenement streets filing toward the Clyde. From up on the 17th story, their views are beauty. You can see the glimmering glass roof of the botanical gardens north of the river, Kelvin Grove Park, the exhibition centre's silver armadillo, and further on, the skyline of the Campsie Fells, keeping the city in. Joe doesn't much look out at these things, though. If he's looking out, it'll be at Ibrox. The ground's a few minutes' walk from the multi just. On match days, he can see the supporters coming in from all around, crowds growing on the pavements outside the pubs, pouring in through the streets. This morning, but he's having a see at the window as the sun comes up, watching the dismal light peter in through the streets that run straight lines toward the river, bending only where they have to go around the stadium, or broken where they've took out the tenements and no got round to replacing them. By the river, there's the twinkling new apartment blocks at Glasgow Harbour, the dry ski centre, and down the water, the shipyards, what's left of them. Govan, this near side, Scotstoun, across the water. From where he is, he can just make out the top of HMS Defender, sat at her berth at Govan. She looks from up here like an Airfix model, with her miniature gun and helicopter pad on the flight deck. That's where Joey's headed. The light nearly up now, and him away out the flat, clicking shut the front door to go pick up Suggy.
It's very resonant, isn't it? It creates the setting very well, but there's also a metaphorical resonance in your writing, isn't there? I particularly love the way that the shipbuilders wrote graffiti on the ship hulls, which then gets painted over, but sort of is almost there, just at the waterline.
Yeah, that scene I put in at the very end, I think. Something I seem to do when I've decided on a title.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's sort of that was sort of top dressing.
Yes, it was. I struggled for a title. I didn't know quite what to call it. A friend suggested to call it Waterline, and I thought, no, that's rubbish. But then I thought, oh, no, I quite like it. And it grew on me, and I decided to call it Waterline. And then I thought, I'm going to solid this up a bit, and it gives me the opportunity to put in something that I hadn't been able to put in before. And so I put in that little scene. And I did the same, actually, with the first book, actually, called God's Own Country. But originally it was called Out Backward, and I wrote a scene, a top-dressed scene in which the main character's mum has an argument with him and says, you must have come out backward. I quite like doing that.
How did you research that voice? I mean, you must have gone to Glasgow, or have you lived there before?
I've not lived there, no. I researched the voice and the language by going to Glasgow, and I suppose combining my sort of factual and place research with voice research, because obviously the people that I was talking to were speaking in a voice that I was wanting to use. And so I went into a shipyard. Everyone was unbelievably helpful, actually, in the city generally, and especially in the shipbuilding industry. The people, the union boys that I spoke to, were great, brilliant. So yeah, I was given a tour around a shipyard, and all the time they're talking and I'm recording these things. And other people who've been involved in the industry and lived in the city for a long time. And I recorded all these things on my dictaphone and I played them back. So that's the main thing. And then also I've worked with a voice coach a little bit to get the rhythm of it. And I've read things, listened to things, used the internet online.
So the rhythm, the voice coach is feeding the rhythm of the writing as well as the rhythm of you reading.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. I knew that there would be an imperative to read the book out when it was published, because you have to read it out like I've just done then. You go to festivals and read it out. So I knew that I would have to at some point think about how I was going to read it. My wife had worked with this voice coach who specialised in Glaswegian, and so she said, well, why don't you speak to her? And I thought, well, I may as well do that right at the beginning of the writing process, because even though she's not going to be that useful at the moment for words and such like, it might be quite interesting to think about the flow and the rhythm of the language and how I might represent that with the writing. And it was useful.
I was really interested in the vocabulary you have. There were some words I had never heard before, and I wondered if they were all genuine or whether you'd cobbled together some. For example, Mick talks about putting a newspaper under his buhuki on the bus to stop the asbestos dirt from his clothes getting on the bus seats. Is that a genuine word?
Yes, genuine word that would be used. Not necessarily a great deal, I don't think, but yes, genuine word.
And blashy weather, that's a genuine word.
Blashy weather is quite that's quite a commonly used phrase, as far as I understand.
Do you collect words, or is this something that just comes to you as you listen to people?
Oh, I collect them. I write them all down. You've got to kind of fund your interest for the period of time of writing. It's, you know, if you're spending 3 years with it, you've got to keep yourself interested every day. And one of the ways I do that is that, you know, I compile like a folder of words, like a lexicon. And so if writing's not going that well, I might work on that a bit, or I might look at those words and see if it gives me any inspiration.
Joe, is this something that comes up for you, the collection of words?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's part of the writer's interest, so at least it would be pretty strange if you weren't. I mean, Submarine was slightly built on obscure words. But, you know, there's just a real pleasure in digging up new ones.
Now, a bit like Ross, your first novel was about a very young person, but actually you're just as interested in the older characters on your commune, aren't you, in this?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to kind of expand my people I was writing about. So
you've got your two main characters. I noticed that you dedicated it to your sisters. And in a way, the most attractive character of all is Kate, who's 17 and trying desperately to go out into the world, having been home educated in this completely wacky environment.
Yes, I got two older sisters. And I suppose Kate is a kind of, not exactly a hybrid, but I was the younger brother and I used to have proper fights with the middle and used to idolise the older, so Kate's a kind of amalgamation of my feelings for my older sisters.
So, are you Albert?
No, I'm not. Absolutely not.
Give us a little taste of what Albert is like and why that might be a rude question.
Okay, I'm going to read a little bit. So I should just say that this is a meditation that Albert's mother has encouraged him to do to try and get him to see beyond the end of the world. And the meditation involves imagining speaking to your older self. So he's going to be speaking to his 16-year-old self. He's 11. Albert, yo, I'm 16. I'm 11. How's the next dimension? Insane. I knew it would be. Non-stop carnage. So what happened? Well, it all started with the swarms. Not just one insect, but all of them. Over land and sea to desiccate the earth. You know some words. I was standing on the flat roof when they blocked out the sun. You could hear them. They were making a documentary about me and they got it on camera when I said, fetch the goddamn gasoline. Wow, yes. Then I poured the gasoline through the woods in a circle around the big house. My henchmen all stood at different points along the circle, each with a box of matches. I went up on the flat roof and everyone waited for my signal. I knew that the forest would only burn for so long and we had to time it right so the swarm would pass by before the forest burned out. That makes sense. I could see the mega swarm coming over the horizon, locusts, hornets, wasps, horseflies, mantises, midges, and I was like, hold, hold, and I could hear the scrit, scrit, scrit of the super intelligent ant armies approaching, carrying hundreds of times their own weight in weaponry, and still I was like, hold, and behind them, the ants, the legions of ticks, mites, beetles, rolling their ball bearings, even spiders, although not strictly insects, swinging through the trees behind, and still I yelled, hold, hold, then I said, let's watch this city burn.
One of the things I found interesting that relates to both of them is that, in a way, the older people both relate to the big seismic shift that happened in the early 1980s, don't they? That the heavy industry got closed down, which affects your characters, mm-hmm. Ross. And all those hippies were taking root in South Wales and other places, mm. which, of course, is the scenario here. Mm. I'm fascinated by it because I suppose, in a way, that the older generation, in a sense, and my generation, yet you have your character, Kate, saying that she doesn't like drugs. She finds it embarrassing because that's what old people do.
Yeah, that was the kind of what I find an interesting angle. Someone born and brought up on a commune and home educated and sees this kind of alternative culture as just incredibly dull and unrebellious. You know, it doesn't have any of the kind of glamour or excitement that I think we often associate with it. I just thought it was quite an interesting perspective.
I could say, Joe, of this book of yours, that you've moved towards the middle class. You could see it as a sort of inversion of the country house novel, couldn't you?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it is my research into communal living is it is a pretty middle class thing, a parallel universe of the country house set.
You have a lovely analogy which you draw between Kate's boyfriend, Geraint, is very bourgeois, one would say, and he has a heptagonal conservatory. And Patrick, who's the sort of dope head on the commune, has a geodesic dome, and one in which people sun each other, the other in which they grow cannabis.
yeah, exactly. That's like a nice thing of Kate runs away to bourgeois cultures. That's her like rebellion, is to go and explore suburbia. Yeah, likes to sun herself in the heptagonal conservatory, and her boyfriend who lives there views the geodesic dome in exactly the same way, and he longs to sleep in late in its steamy interior.
Are you familiar with geodesic domes yourself, since I've asked Ross all about his research?
I mean, I've been slept in one, yes.
But you don't come from that background?
No, a good friend of mine grew up in a Welsh commune, and I've always found her upbringing really fascinating, and spent quite a bit of time with her where she grew up and went to various other ones in Scotland and in Devon and in different parts of England. And yeah, just going back to what you said about it being time specific, it is relevant that it's set now because it's a kind of post-hippie commune. I think that whole sex and drugs 60s thing is really not relevant to most modern communes anymore. And most of them are quite pragmatic and quite functional. I was interested in trying to move away from the romantic ideas. I had this idea of, you know, trying to write a kind of communal novel that was kind of boring in its way, but obviously you don't want to do that as a novelist. But I wanted to try and capture something a little bit more mundane, not just about taking mushrooms and, you know, whatever.
This is gloomy stuff, isn't it? Is there light at the end of the tunnel at the geodesic dome?
Is your book gloomy? I've not read it yet. The cover looks quite chirpy.
The cover does look chirpy. Yeah, they've tried to make it look very upbeat. Yeah, no, mine's, I'd say, tonally chirpy.
It's a comedy. Spell it out. It is a sort of comedy, isn't it?
Yes, it's a sort of comedy.
But it deals with quite paranoid individuals.
Yeah, it's got unhappy people, but they're in a comedy.
I think you don't set out to write, you don't go, oh, right, I'm going to sit down and spend 3 years writing a really miserable book. I think you decide what the book is going to be and you start writing it, and I knew that the themes quite early on were going to be bereavement and homelessness and asbestos, and they're not very cheery subjects. It would be quite odd if the book was a cheery one. I mean, hopefully there are moments of humour and lightness in it, but broadly speaking, it's quite sad.
Well, thank you both very much for coming in. And I do actually, despite the possibly downbeat tone, I do think they are both very good books. So do go along and see for yourselves.
Claire Armitstead talking to Ross Raisin and Joe Dunthorne, and their books, Waterline and Wild Abandon, are out now. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be speaking to A.L. Kennedy about her new novel, The Blue Book, and giving you a flavour of the delights in store at this year's Edinburgh International Book Festival, which opens its doors on August 13th. And Richard, could you just quickly run us through what we've got coming up over the weekend?
Yes, in this week's Guardian Review, A.S. Byatt talks about her rewriting of the Ragnarok myth. Stuart Kelly is profiling Janice Galloway, and Alfred Hickling reviews Amos Oz's short stories. In the Observer New Review on Sunday, Leo Benedictus writes about the real Mad Men, and Jane O'Grady reviews Raymond Tallis's Aping Mankind. We've also got an interview with David Nichols by Rachel Cook.
Plenty to look forward to there, but for now, thanks to Richard Lee, Chris Moran, Joe Dunthorne and Ross Raisin. The producer was Ian Chambers. I'm Sarah Crown, and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.